You asked me to name the most underappreciated success in consumer startup history. The first that would pop into my head would be Mark Ganey and Strava. Mark founded Strava in 2009, which now powers 130 million athletes all over the world. It adds millions of new members a month, and a whopping 96% of this growth is fully organic. Strava works by connecting to your wearables, passively tracking your workouts, and sharing them with friends. In 2021, they raised $1 billion at a $6 billion valuation. I'm Zane Sabag, and you're listening to the Apreneurs Podcast. Today's questions were informed by over 2 years of conversations with Mark, and we'll explore how Strava's unconventional early strategies shaped it into the winner it is today.
Thanks so much, Mark, for being here. Could you tell us a little bit about your early days running the MVP test for Strava? You told me lots of great stories about collecting watches, giving them to your friends, and then trying to extract the data manually from them.
Yeah. Well, Zane, thanks for having me here. It's really fun. And we're going to go walk down memory lane. So early days of Strava, you've got to go back to that 2008, 2009 period. So a couple of things for people to be aware of. This was really the very early days of mobile. The iPhone was only launched in 2007. So the idea of mobile apps and things was not in people's vernacular, which means Strava was a mobile company. We were web-based. We built a website. We affectionately called the Green Machine because it was a pretty hideous shade of green, but it had a lot of features in it, built by our early engineer, a great guy named Davey Kitchell, who's still with the company. And it had everything but the kitchen sink in it. But the challenge was, in order to participate on Strava, you're right, you had to have a Garmin device, typically a cycling computer that you normally had on your handlebars. You have to take it off your handlebars, plug it into the back of the computer, and then upload the data. That was the way you participated. And then you go off and do another ride and take it back off and plug it back in. And our hope and theory was that we could provide enough insight, information, kind of entertaining, fun experiences on that Strava website that you want to keep doing it. So what did that mean? That meant, law of small numbers. When we were recruiting our friends to do it, which means I remember the very first customer who wasn't a Strava employee who was on Strava. His name was David. He's still with us now, 15 years later. I remember creating a competition in the summer of 2008, where we probably had 20 users, maybe. I mean, this is a company now today that has, I think we're about 130 million. So, but I remember the first 20, and we basically challenged them to compete with each other for the month of July, 2008. The reason that was valuable to us is that by getting them on, allowing them to compete with each other, we could watch their behavior with Strava. We could watch the way they interacted with the web application, with the website. We watched the way that they interacted with us as a business, but we also watched the way they interacted amongst themselves. And that, we didn't know we were building a social app at the time, but we clearly saw that there was this dynamic in a really fun way, kind of the trash talking and just esprit de corps that comes from sort of this shared love of a sport, turned out to be really effective. Last thing I'll just say was, we also knew from day one, we wanted to support a global community of people who are active, athletes across lots of different sports and activities. But our go-to-market strategy was very focused. We picked one group, and that was the passionate road cyclist, and we tried to build features unique to them. And our thesis was, if we could do it well for them, that would give us enough credibility in the market and confidence to then expand out. So the early days that you'll ask me about, they're all hyper-focused on that. We used to joke they were mammals, middle-aged men in Lycra. But it worked, because having that focus on that very targeted audience allowed us to kind of create momentum to then have the confidence to.
Could you expand a little bit more about mammals? I think one of the things young consumer founders struggle a lot with is building very strong and specific pain points with their users and building empathy.
Yeah, so you're right. That mammal, that middle-aged man in Lycra that we were building for, this was this somebody who, we knew that they were passionate about cycling. They'd probably spent a fair bit of money already on their bicycle and so forth, and we were targeting them. So why go so niche? And trust me, there was a lot of pressure not to do it. Investors are worried about the addressable market. We're trying to figure whether there's a business there, but we were willing to take the risk. And the phrase we've used for years is, go inch wide, mile deep. Because in doing so, once you've identified a targeted audience, you can go and create a conversation with them where you really can start to understand their needs, their challenges, their issues, their opportunities, that as you expand the universe of potential users, only gets harder. I often joke it's the we call it the Starbucks effect. And quick anecdote, but I was with a good friend of mine who's a consultant in the consumer subscription space, really bright. She's written books on the topic. And we were meeting at a local Starbucks one day, and I was telling her about Strava. This is the early days. And she said, well, tell me about your target audience. And it just so happened that there were a small group of cyclists sitting in a corner. They'd probably finished their ride and they were drinking their espresso. And I said, well, see those four folks over there? That's who we're building. And her eyes lit up because she's like, Mark, normally when I ask an entrepreneur that, they'll quickly say, well, the beauty of our business is that, see, anybody who's here inside Starbucks, we can meet their needs. And she says, that scares me to death because that is so distributed and so diverse that how can you possibly be great for all those? So to me, one of the challenges that you want to focus on in the earliest days is how can you be not just good, great? And in order to be great, it requires focus. And that if you do that, you have to have the confidence that allows you that opportunity for expansion. So our focus on mammals was to understand why they rode, how far they rode, what they were looking for from their rides, who they were riding with. And as we did that, we weren't just building what they were asking for. That doesn't really work. But you can begin to see where the nuggets. Best little example I'll give you. We learned from talking to cyclists that they love their quad. Doesn't matter whether they're on a 5-mile ride or a 100-mile ride. There's usually some really important climb in the middle of that ride. Yeah. Here in the Bay Area, it's Old La Honda. Everybody wants to go and do Old La Honda. And so once we understood that, we took that and said, oh, well, I bet we could auto-identify climb. We'll look at the data. And if it's a certain length and a certain sort of grade, we can auto-identify that climb and we can pull that out from the ride and we can show someone, hey, here's how you did on the climb. And here's how difficult the climb was. And we can give it a bunch of different sort of characteristics.
And here's who you beat.
Yes. And well, that's what happened. So then the next thing that we built that, and the next thing that our customer asked for was, hey, my friend was on that same climb yesterday. Could you show me how I did relative to him or her? Oh yeah, we can create. And so we created leaderboards. And then it turned out that not only did the climb of interest, but there were other pieces of road that people were really interested in. And so that was basically where Strava Segments became from. For anybody familiar with Strava, the app, Segments is sort of this critical piece of the experience where now any piece of road, trail, climb, you name it, you can create your own segment. But that whole thing was basically founded on the premise that cyclists love climbs and how do we sort of create that? And that created the social layer, that created the competitive layer, that created, you know, unique IP for Strava. We never would have found had we not had that conversation, would have said, yeah, that climb is, that's what I care about on my ride.
Yeah, I mean, segments continue to be one of my favorite parts about Strava. It's really nice getting like 15 awards after your run, seeing where you're ranking on
each
segment.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. And they're very different for a runner versus a cyclist versus a walker. They serve different purposes. But we picked up that core piece of, again, the feature set within Strava from those early conversations. And then you can just see how it has a life of its own as you mature the product.
Absolutely. Could you talk a little bit more about very early grassroots recruitment for Strava and what that looked like?
Sure. Yeah. Again, this is where I will joke about the law of small numbers. You know, everybody wants to get excited. You know, today Strava adds anywhere from 1 to 2 million members per month. Trust me, it took us years to get to that kind of growth rate. And so early, I often joke, Zane, you and I have probably talked about in the past, you have to be comfortable doing things that don't scale. So examples of, I'll give you just two examples of things we did that didn't scale. Number one, we went out to the local Costco and cut a deal where they would give us garments at basically, and we would take our personal money and maybe a few thousand, but we bought a lot of Garmin devices that we could then hand out or give it an even greater discount to our friends and the friends of friends and so forth. And was it something we would think we'd be doing 3 years later? No. But in the early days, how could we get people to be in just sort of giving us feedback and use it? So buying garments, you know, enabling people to participate. And then another thing that we did, we realized that cycling is very social. Oftentimes you're out riding with other friends. So we came up with these, they almost look like little Strava business cards, and they were somewhat waterproof, so or I'll call them sweatproof. And we would give them to a lot of our early members to have in their back pockets and their jerseys, so that when they're out riding, they could hand them to their friends, because we really felt that our growth was going to be organic, was going to be through the social layer, through the network of people who were already out there. And that's proven to be the case. 96% of our growth continues to be organic, just word of mouth. So how do we enable word of mouth? Well, sometimes it's as simple as, again, handing a piece of paper to somebody and saying, hey, you should check this out. This is what I'm on. So I would just, what I would want to encourage entrepreneurs to do is be very comfortable doing things early that you know 2 years later would make no sense. But if you're just trying to go from 1 to 2 users and then 2 to 4 and then 4 to 8 and then 8 to 16, it's okay to sort of do the things to just get to that number. And trust me, pretty soon you're going from 100 to 200 and 1,000 to 2,000. And you know, you'll figure out how to do each of those incremental sort of growth phases at the right time. But doing non-scalable, early stage, guerrilla marketing to get people on, then is focus on engagement. This is the other thing people miss. Growth for growth's sake, you'll churn them out. This is quick, right? But if you're really diligent about, now that we have somebody who's on Strava, how do we ensure they're going to stay on Strava? Mission critical. Sometimes we get so focused on how to grow that we forget, wait, are our existing customers having fun? Are they still with it? Much easier to keep a customer than it is to keep working for new ones.
Could you double tap on that a little bit? You've told me a lot that organic growth comes from engagement. Can you talk a little bit about the single player utility for Strava and how you focused on that in the beginning?
Yeah. So you're referring to a couple of things. One, I'll double down on when I'm speaking to your engagement, there's all kinds of different metrics you can look at sort of the success of a business. A lot of people focus on, you know, your growth rates, how many new users you're adding, you know, how your revenue is growing. These are critical. We found at Strava, we had one metric that we focused on that sort of drive success then in all the other metrics. It was engagement. It was the frequency and the passion with which our existing members were using Strava on a daily, weekly, monthly basis. It's a workout app, so use it every day is pretty hard. But if someone were on it weekly and monthly, that was a really good sign. How do we keep people doing it? And if we did, two good things happened. One was, if somebody was happy to engage, more than likely they were inviting their friends, so we were getting the viral growth. And we believed over time, we could build enough value in our subscription that they would pay for the upgrade, which is our source of revenue. So that was the thesis. Now, how did we get there? That you referred to single player mode versus we'll call it sort of that multiplayer mode. Strava today is known for a lot of its community-based features, the fact that it's a very tight community worldwide. And so everybody wants to ask me about how to build a community. What they forget is that when Strava started, we had a customer base of one. And we had to figure out how to build enough value in the Strava experience that one customer would come back again and stay engaged. And then two customers may not even know each other, but they're both using Strava. How do you do it? That's our single player mode. And I can't emphasize enough, if you don't have utility that is highly sort of not just sufficient, but engaging for a user, it's very hard to then think about the community opportunities that might exist in the future. So in the case of Strava, we put a lot of thought into what is the feedback loop we're creating, because in essence, we were what we call a post ride or a post activity experience. You go do something, whether it's ride, run, ski, whatever the activity is, you post it to Strava, good things should happen there. And so we spent a lot of time just thinking about, if there were nobody else in the system, what kind of feedback would we provide? And it just naturally happened that was a lot of the early feature set. And then over time, there were features that became somewhat social. We talked earlier about, you know, climbs and comparing climbs and then leaderboards. So there was sort of a natural progression into the social, but it didn't happen overnight. It itself was kind of this organic process of looking for social that was authentic.
Absolutely. Could you talk a little bit more about what you mean by post-workout and how Strava's evolved over time to include during workout and pre-workout?
Yeah. So we think of it, our user base and the way in which this kind of the use cases, lots of different ways, but one simple way to think about it is, anybody who is active, there's three modes. They're either getting ready to be active, they're currently active, or they've just finished being active. So there's the pre, the during, and the post. And you're right, Strava's DNA was very much sort of born out of post activity. You go do a ride, you go do a run, you post it to Strava, and hopefully you have some fun after. The next phase that happened for us was, we got deeply involved in the during process. And that was when we launched our mobile app. The original reason that we launched mobile was to solve a very specific problem, which was, it was really expensive for someone to participate on Strava if they had to go buy a Garmin. So in 2011, 2012, we really made the investment to begin to build a mobile app that would allow someone to track their activity. So we became engaged in that, while you're active, what's the role Strava can play? And it was basically, it was a glorified stopwatch. It was real track. How far, how long, you know, if you had a heart rate monitor, we'll pull that data in. There are a handful of things that we were trying to do while you were working out. And then you're right, that has led to now, if you fast forward to the Strava experience, I know a lot of where I spend my time as a Strava user is pre-workout. Well, what do I want to go do? And who do I want to do it with? And on Strava, because there's all kinds of mapping features and routing features and discovery features. And, you know, there's event location. There's all kinds of things that kind of enable me to like, ooh, what do I want to go do today? And so I often open Strava before a workout to either decide where I want to run or I'm inviting friends to join me on a run. So we've sort of, as we've matured as a company, those opportunities have been unlocked and we've been able to now make offerings across all three of the modes of being active. But you have to be patient. You know, one thing we probably knew all along that there were all these different modes. The pre-mode only became valuable once we had enough data inside Strava to create experiences around route or trail discovery, things like that. In the early days, the data didn't exist. And I want to challenge entrepreneurs. You need to go hard and fast and break things while simultaneously being patient and just knowing that if you're patient in the process, you can ultimately create just award-winning product. It does take longer than you think.
Something Alexis, the founder of Reddit, talks a lot about is spending hours on Reddit initially when it first launched and really creating a lot of the content, creating a lot of the engagement in the app. I think you have well over 1,000 followers on Strava. Can you talk a little bit about how your personal use of the app drove any sort of engagement early on?
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, because as you think about my followers, it's a small following compared to other people on Strava, which is just, it's amazing to see. I mean, we have members now who have hundreds of thousands of followers, a lot of these professional cyclists and things like that. I think I've never been asked that question, Zane. It's a really good one. I would say that my use as a Strava member to enable its success probably had less to do with the followers I had, although it helped. I think it had to do with just the way in which, as I was active and could populate an area with, we call it Strava heat. So anytime I would go run somewhere, that now is data on Strava. And so I had the privilege of going out and creating all the segments, you know, here on the peninsula and where I live, which is just south of San Francisco. So that was really fun because in some ways I'm sort of mapping the active world in my area. And I was the leader. I was the we call them KOMs for cyclists or CRs for runners, the course records or KOM. I was basically the leader on all these segments. Now I've spent the last 15 years being told every week by Strava that you've lost your KOM here and you've lost your KOM. So now there's a lot of people who are faster than me, but I think that if I point to sort of where I was most helpful, A, we're just kind of populating the system with data, and B, look, I'm as passionate a user as I am a founder. And so all kinds of little tweaks around the feature set and, you know, what's working and wasn't, that was kind of that collaborative work that we were doing with the rest of our team was critical.
Absolutely. I think that's a great point to talk a little bit more about your background. A lot of times, you know, VCs are looking for founders that, you know, the product was made for them and they're the perfect user of the product. Can you talk a little bit more about your background as a rower and as an athlete?
Sure. Yeah, I think so. It is true. I am one of those fortunate entrepreneurs who has kind of found an industry where I'm also just passionate as an individual. Goes back to, you know, my youth. So I grew up in Reno, Nevada. And if you grew up in Reno, it's a pretty fun place if you enjoy the outdoors, because I was either playing soccer or I was running or I was skiing or I was up in Tahoe, just loving the outdoors and being really competitive. Was a competitive runner in high school and that got me into college. And then college, I switched and became a competitive runner. That's where I met my co-founder, Michael Horvath. We've been best friends for, you know, 30 something years. So sports are in my DNA. I've gone on to compete in everything from Ironman triathlons to, you know, long distance mountain bike races, wow. You know, long distance running, marathons and things. So you're right. Part of my DNA is that I just love to be outdoors and being active. So I think that helps with Strava. That being said, I would not say it is critical to the success. In fact, I'd argue you have to be careful when you're passionate about a space where you're trying to build a business. You need to make sure that you're objective enough around what you're building, that you're not just building for yourself. Honestly, I think one of the challenges that Strava faced in the early days, we were often accused of building for kind of the hardcore athletes and the most elite athletes in the world. And that was never our intent. Our thesis was just, let's make sure we build to meet the standards of the most demanding athletes in the world. We felt if we didn't do that, it would be very hard to service others. But what we didn't want to do was in any way sort of intimidate people. I think we worked really hard in the last 5 to 6 years to ensure that Strava can be inviting to anybody, regardless of their athletic background, regardless of how fast they are. It's not about performance. It's about simply enjoying that feeling you get when you're active and being supported by other people who are trying to do the same thing. And there's a balance. That's just a long way of saying, you don't have to be a runner to go and start a running company. You don't have to be a cyclist to start a cycling company. It helps a little bit, but it's by no means an issue.
Thank you. Can you talk a little bit about when you knew you might want to start a company with Michael and how your friendship / working dynamic evolved over the years?
Oh, sure. Yeah, so we got to go back to the last century for stuff saying. I'm gonna age myself here, dinosaur, because our first company was founded in 95, 1996. I had come out of college in 1990. Michael was 2 years ahead of me, met on the crew team, as I mentioned, and we were good friends in college. He'd gone off, he got his PhD in economics, and he was teaching at Stanford. He was teaching macroeconomics at the time. I had just left working for a venture capital firm called TA Associates in late 95 and wanted to be an entrepreneur. So I was trying to do two things. One was trying to figure out what business could I launch. And I was also desperately looking for co-founder, or at least a co-founder. And most of my good friends turned me down. They're like, you're crazy, what are you doing? But Michael was great. Michael was working at Stanford. I used to joke that his greatest contribution was that he had an office in 1995 that had a high student rate, which was really hard to come by back then. And so regardless of whether he was a founder, I just like going to his office because we could actually surf the web, if you wanted to call it that back then, on a decent internet connection. But those conversations just led to more. I think he caught the bug along with me. And ultimately, when we founded Kana, we figured out a relationship that worked well. He didn't leave academia. Michael stayed in academia and was busy, starting a family. So we were co-founders at Kana. He contributed a ton, particularly to the early days there. And I was fortunate that I could be the one who was running it and be full-time. So that was our Kana experience. If you fast forward to Strava, we were in a place where both of us had the freedom to work on it together, 50-50. And at that point, we had enough trust in each other because we'd done the first company. And we sort of know each other's strength. I like to joke. I mean, I hold on to Michael with an iron fist because there's nobody smarter. There's nobody who understands his, as a PhD in economics, he has a way of looking at our business in a way that's different from me. He looks at it oftentimes through the lens of the numbers and the data. And I probably just see it from a vantage point that's around the story and maybe some of the qualitative aspects of it. And those things seem to marry really well. But yeah, it was a relationship formed over decades and, not without its ups and downs. He and I could tell you all kinds of challenges we've had along the way, but never putting the friendship at risk.
I love that. I wanted to talk a little bit about trying to build Strava the first time, right before you launched Kana, and why timing is really important for you.
Yeah, I'll be the first to acknowledge, luck plays such a huge role in any of these startup endeavors. So what you're referring to is when I left TA Associates in the fall of 1995, I had an idea that I wanted to pursue. It was a virtual locker room on the internet. There was this new thing called the internet, and we thought it'd be really interesting to try to build a business there. And I had a personal problem, which is having graduated and left rowing, there was this void in my life, actually for both Michael and I. We both felt the same thing, which was we really missed the camaraderie and the esprit de corps and the trash talking, everything that came from being on that team while in college. And the problem was once we graduated, it just disappeared. Despite, continuing training and participating in weekend fun runs and things, it just wasn't the same. So we had this theory, that we could build this virtual locker room on the internet, this new thing called the internet. We called it Kana Sports. It was named after my dog. And we went about looking for partners that could help us build it. We went and looked on a website development company, and we began talking to other sports companies that might be our sponsors. That was the business model that we were contemplating. And again, what sounds like kind of basic stuff today, 25 years later, it was not so basic back then. So the bad news was we were way too early for the idea. The reality was, how are we going to get people to seamlessly put their data into Strava, their workout? We're going to have to sit down and type it in. That's not very compelling. There wasn't such a thing as subscription business models at that point. The folks we hoped would be our advertisers and our sponsors, they were only just now starting to understand what their internet strategy was going to be. So there was a lot of friction. But as we talked to these sports companies, a number of them kept telling us, geez, we don't think we want to sponsor you because, frankly, we're already getting too many messages and emails from customers. We don't want any more emails. And we kept hearing this problem over and over. Like,
how could it be a bad thing?
You want more customer email? Don't you want them to communicate with you? So we kind of that natural, you know, you and I were just talking earlier before we went online here, you know, pivot versus evolve. You know, I'm not sure what the right word is, but we heard that and we're like, well, gosh, if we're ever going to get these companies to support our virtual locker room, we should help them solve their customer email problem. And so Kana Sports actually became Kana Communication because we ended up identifying a very big problem in the market around customer email management and just how to help companies as they began to build their businesses online. How would they manage their customer relationship online? And we it turned out that sports companies weren't the only one with that problem. Anybody who was going online did that. So Michael and I ended up building Kana Communications. And over the next 4 or 5 years, we went from two guys and a dog, 1,200 employees, and company went public, and it was really fun. We had a great ride. And we're the first to acknowledge it had nothing to do with sports, which again goes back to my point. You don't have to be passionate to have fun building something. There's as much fun that comes from just the process itself and frankly, being on a great team.
Speaking about building great teams, can you talk a little bit about the motivation to hire some of your early users as early employees?
Well, yeah. Okay. So there's, I don't know how common that is. And this was sort of just taking full advantage of the circumstances. So at Strava, the first two really key outside hires we made, and for all intents and purposes, we really made these guys co-founders of the business, were two gentlemen named Mark and Chris that we had known at Kana. We had hired them straight out of, they'd actually had just graduated from Stanford as undergrads in computer science. And they joined our team at Kana in the early days. And they were two fantastic developers who also happened to be fantastic people and just the kind of teammates that you would want involved in any business. And so when you fast forward to the early days of Strava, we weren't necessarily looking for Mark and Chris to be on our team. We knew they were also passionate cyclists. And so we said, hey guys, you understand software, you understand technology and your cyclists. Would you try that and give us feedback? And I genuinely, if all they had done was given us feedback, I think that would have been great. But they did get excited. They gave us a lot of feedback and that immediately triggered, oh gosh, would they also be willing to work with us full time? So I don't know that every entrepreneur has that opportunity where they kind of have friends they might be able to pull in. I will say though that someone should not overthink sort of how they pull teams together. People are passionate about an idea or they have a trust in what you're trying to do. As long as you're fair and as long as you're transparent, you ask for help. You ask, you know, do you have time? And if someone says no, no problem. You know, you've done it.
Right.
I can tell you, you and I've had some other conversations where I get more and more excited at opportunities to build software companies because the challenges we had in 1995 of trying to get a piece of software from sort of concept to commercialization, it was exceptionally hard. Like it was a 6 to 9 month process. And then you delivered it on a disk to your customer. I mean, it was, and then maybe 6 months later, you do the next version of it. And then with Strava, we got really excited when we could do nightly deploys and begin really sort of, you know, evolving the product on a daily, weekly basis. Now, you know, Zane, you and I, again, we've talked offline. You don't even have to be a software developer to think about the way in which you develop code, given the sort of automated tools that are out there today. So I'm not suggesting you don't need to hire really smart people who are good at technology and good developers, but I am very excited as an entrepreneur that I think it's only becoming easier and easier for us to bring our ideas to life. And whether that's through your friends or your extended network, look, as an entrepreneur, you beg, borrow, and steal all the time. Maybe it's not steal, that's the wrong word. But you beg and borrow a lot. And then you do that and you just remember who was there for you and you ensure that you treat them well going forward.
Words to live by, certainly. Yeah, I think the opportunity to just build software very, very fast without having much of a very strong software background is something I felt in particular when we first started building out Candid and Roll and Vitals. Now, I knew almost nothing about writing code for production. And now Matthew and I are the ones writing code end to end. Very exciting.
You're one of my, we were joking earlier, you're just a beacon for me in terms of anybody says, but it's really expensive and challenging to sort of build. It's like, I'm not sure that's the right mindset.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Not today. Kriya, one of the things that really fascinates me about Strava is how well you guys have managed to pack so many different features into a relatively straightforward interface. Can you tell me a little bit about the building process? I have a couple questions here. One of the things you mentioned to me in a previous conversation is initially when you expanded to running, you built two separate apps.
Yeah.
Could you tell me about the decision to unify those?
Yeah. Yeah. So then actually I'll preface all my comments by saying, I'm not sure. I would agree with you that we have a lot of features packed into a pretty tight app. I don't know that serves our community as well as I would like. I do think that you'll read a lot about sort of simplicity is bliss and, you know, that reducing one's experience is as important, you know, the editing process of anything, including software, is important. So I actually think we probably have too many things that are kind of hidden away that are hard to find. But I appreciate the compliment for sure. So now let's talk about how we went from cycling and running, because you're right. We made the strategic decision when we decided to go into running to launch a separate second app called Strava Run. We had Strava Cycling, Strava Bike, I can't remember, but we did not, the biggest concern we had was that we did not want our existing community to feel as though we were in any way shortchanging their experience. And we felt the more we learned about running, we realized these are not the same experience. They might be some of the same underlying technologies, but at their core, we really wanted each of those audiences to know that we were looking at their needs in an authentic way. So you're right. We launched two apps and it was difficult because now you're trying to market two apps. And now you're trying to think about deployment of resources across two apps. No question it was a challenge. Was it the right or wrong decision? You know, I don't think that's one we second guess much, other than within the next 2 years, we worked very hard to then merge the two and bring them together. And we found that merging was invaluable because it turned out many of our users, many of our members, they were doing both activity.
Yeah.
So it turns out most people are not just one activity only. They're, you know, seasonality and just change of pace and whatever goal they have allows them to kind of do different activities. And it was much more important that Strava sort of recognize that user experience than to be authentic. The initial thinking was we want to make sure that we get the experience right and that our customer feels like we're meeting their need.
Absolutely. Yum. How did you balance pressure early on to monetize with just building the best experience possible for users?
So I'd like to think that this comes from some of my DNA all the way back to my 4+ years at TA Associates, my first job. That job, the firm was a very unique firm in that it looked for established companies that were bootstrapped. So they were entrepreneurially owned, they had not raised outside capital, and they were also profitable and growing. So we were looking for investment opportunities that were pretty rare, at least in Silicon Valley. although it turns out that when you go out to the rest of the world, that's what a lot of companies have to do. Like, they don't have access to venture capital. So it's important to Strava because Michael and I both believe that great companies, their success is predicated not on how many eyeballs they have or just on NPS scores or, you know, monthly active users. Ultimately, a great business is measured on its ability to generate revenue and profitability. Those are the core. And frankly, Michael and I had a chip on our shoulder because at Kana, we had tremendous growth, top line revenue, but in the 6 years that we were there, the company was never profitable. It was the phrase that we use, or the acronym in that, in those days, was GBF, get big fast. It was a total land grab. It was a market share game. It was
scaling.
It was all scale. And we went public on that premise, and we had a crazy market cap on that premise, but it always bothered us because the fundamentals weren't sound. It was right. always kind of a company that, frankly, when the sort of internet sort of imploded in the early 2000s, companies like Kata really struggled because they just didn't have the cash. So for Michael and I, part of our thesis with Strava was, hey, this should be a company that's built to last. One of our favorite books. If you haven't read it, it's an old one. It's a good one. It's a great business book, built to last. We wanted that DNA at Strava. So what did that mean? That meant from almost the day we started, we created a subscription model, freemium, so you could use Strava for free, or that you could upgrade. Initially, it was usage-based, and then it became feature-based. And our thesis was really simple, which was, we'll know if we're building a great product when someone's willing to pay us. And we you know, here we are 15 years later, we're still very much of that mindset, that the best way we know that our product is working is that someone see enough value that they want to pay. And in a world where we're inundated with subscriptions and so forth, sometimes it's a high bar, but I believe that even the current management team believes deeply that, that's the way to measure our success.
Yeah, I think Strava is an exceptional case in that a lot of like prosumer companies or consumer companies, they have very, very low monetization rates. So about like 1% of people actually pay for the product. And I don't think that's Strava.
No, yeah, we don't publish our numbers, but I can tell you it's much, much better than that. And look, to be clear, it's not everybody. Anybody who wants to use Strava for free, we love having them as free members. One of the wonderful things about Strava is that our free members are contributing value. Every time they upload an activity to Strava, that enhances the experience, not just for themselves, but for everybody else. So we don't look at our free users as somehow just sort of taking advantage of us. Like, they are contributing great. We're just hopeful over time that they will see that the features that are on the other side of the paywall could be of value, and that they'll at least want to try the subscription.
Absolutely.
Either way, we're you know, it's one of those funny things. We're happy either way, as long as people feel engaged and enjoy it. Thankfully, there's enough, you know, there's enough percentage of our members that are subscribers that it makes for a really great, healthy business.
Yeah, I think it's a, you know, very compelling case for both network effect and data effect. Using the free users as content for the paid users, it's phenomenal, and, you know, deepening both of their engagements and attention. I want to ask something specific. Yeah, anecdotally, as a Strava user, the paywall pop-up comes up almost every single day for me, and every single day I'm tempted to buy it. And I think it's done in a way so that it, you know, almost annoying enough. Yeah.
Yeah, that's funny. As a subscriber myself, I don't see that. So I can tell you it'll go away.
Yeah.
If you pay. Yeah. And I'll give credit to our team. We're constantly iterating on what that should look like, how to figure out that balance between being persistent, but not annoying, continuing to add value. One of the key things is, it's not good enough just to be really good at selling it, but are we continuing to just increase the value of the subscription so that every day you look, there's something else that might be interesting? We put a lot of thought into what should be on one side of the paywall or the other. There was a period of time where we felt like anything new we were doing should go on the subscription side. You know, we've not that we backpedaled, but we continue to evolve that thinking. And now we see some things should be free versus others. A perfect example, we took something that used to be paid for, Beacon, and we made it free because it's a great safety feature. And we didn't want that to be a hindrance. We didn't want people to just, only if they could afford it, could they use it. So that's a good example of taking something that used to be paid for and moving it across the other way. So it's an art, it's not a science. But yeah, you're going to continue to be annoyed until you at least give the subscription a try.
That's very principled decision-making, taking that paid feature that's a safety purpose.
Yeah, no, I kudos to the team. I think we know sacred cow. So constantly going back and just looking at, you know, what's in the best interest of the community, and how do we match that with the business? It should be if we do this right, it's a win-win-win. Customer wins, company wins, shareholders win. And when we're doing it right, that's what it feels like.
Yeah, I think one thing Strava does so well is being you know, a gatekeeper of very serious user location data. I love that it erases the initial to the start and end segments from your run so that people, you know, can't see where you're starting from, or, you know, develop the habit of stalking you. It's really hard to see some of these activities when you're not friends, or impossible. So massive kudos to you guys on privacy. How did that thinking evolve over time? Were there any you know, early days, like very early days, that kind of threw red flags at you?
Yeah, I mean, it has definitely evolved over time as we've learned sort of what the opportunities are technology-wise. You've kind of highlighted a couple of key features that, frankly, we're constantly trying to promote. Again, these are free features that allow for greater privacy. And whether it's something like hiding your start and stop or enabling you to just always be private unless you otherwise decide. So you're right. We've got the good news I can tell to any Strava member is take the time to look at our privacy settings, decide how you want to sort of be present on Strava. And more than likely, we've given you that option. Did that evolve over time? 100%. Were there moments, probably one of the most intense moments that we had, there was a wrongful death lawsuit on Strava in our early years. Really sad situation where a cyclist was descending, was going downhill very fast and crossed over double yellow line and ran into a car and died. And shortly before the statute of limitations was to happen, the family members of this person sued Strava and accused us of basically being an event organizer and bore you with the details, but you know, came after us pretty hard with somehow we had caused this death. Yeah, we fought it. We looked internally and said, no, this is something we should defend. And we did. And the case was thrown out and we were able to move on. But it did sort of, you know, I wouldn't be honest if I didn't say we had to sort of take a hard look and say, are there ways we could improve? And part of it was as simple as just making sure we're having an ongoing conversation with our community. Part of it wasn't changing any features. Part of it was just saying, look, the intent here is to enjoy being active. It's to support one another in this process. That means things like obeying the rules of the road. That means being respectful of one another. That means being respectful of others who are also trying to use trails and roads and so forth. So one of the things that came out of that incident was just simply some community standards. If you're going to be a member of our community, forget our, you know, privacy regulations and terms and conditions. Here's the standards by which we expect you to behave. You're going to be a member. So, you know, there have been moments like that. In general, I would say we've just constantly are evaluating trust and safety and privacy.
Thank you so much. Just a couple of final questions. Anecdotally, I think that a lot of VCs are probably big Strava users. There's like a lot of fitness hype, running hype in the VC community. Can you talk about how that's interfered with any sort of races?
Well, probably at the end of the day, interfere in a good way. I'll preface by saying Strava is not unlike any other startup out there, which is that we've had our challenges raising money for obvious reasons. It's, you know, fitness is a category. While it's seen a lot of capital come into it, it's not one that investors immediately jump to. There have always been questions about, you know, the addressable market size and, you know, how big and you know, how loyal and, you know, aren't you going to get crushed by XYZ company? So these are good questions. They should be asked over and over. And Strava faced those a lot. Where we tended to find success with investors was when we identified investors who also happened to be Strava users. And why did that work? My theory is that it worked because once you're a member and you actually have a sense of the experience, you recognize some of the unique qualities that exist that make Strava pretty special as a business. So that was a natural. It was just much easier for us to talk to somebody who already understood the user experience. And now we could talk about the financials and the aspect of the business. Whereas if you're trying to explain Strava to somebody who doesn't like being active, that's a tough rock to push uphill. There's a lot of evangelizing. So yes, if you go back and look at most of our raises, someone who was in the middle of that investment was more than likely active enough that they're like, look, you need to understand these things about the business. And I would say that that's going to be important for any entrepreneur. As you're thinking about fundraising, trying to connect the dots between someone who will have some sense for the domain and also has that investment mindset, that's going to be your biggest win. It's okay. A lot of people don't get it. Don't waste time with them. It's your, we used to call it bloody knuckle syndrome. Don't get bloody knuckles knocking on the door for somebody who's not going to appreciate what you're doing. It's okay. It's not a reflection on you or the business. It's just people have different areas of expertise and interests, and those play a big role in raising money, particularly early.
Do you think Strava has at all eased apprehensions investors might have about investing in consumer sports companies?
Well, for every Strava, there's another company that you know has imploded or made it challenging. And you know, I'd like to think that we've played a positive role. I would tell you there's one thing that's kind of been in the middle of Strava's life cycle that I think has made this particular discussion somewhat challenging, and that's COVID. You know, because in the early days of COVID, anything related to sports and fitness was just on a rocket. We just had this global focus on health and wellness. You had people who no longer had to commute, and so they had time to be active. And so, you know, we saw a tremendous influx of capital into the space. And for better or worse, some of those companies turned out to be COVID darlings, but post-COVID, they're not able to meet expectations. Strava went through its own, you know, just trying to figure out how to forecast growth was really challenging. Thankfully for us, we're on the other side. And I mean, our business today is stronger than it's ever been. So we're really happy with what we believe is a continuing trend in the space. But for every one of Strava's, I can name three or four companies that did not make it through that chasm or that period. And that weighs heavily on investors. They're just as aware of those unfortunate circumstances as they are as of Strava's. That's a long way of saying, I don't know that it's any easier today in the space. Just, yeah, you have to be patient, and it's a numbers game. You have to talk to a lot. You're going to raise capital, be prepared to talk to a lot of potential investors and treat it literally like a second business. It's literally, you're going to have to parallel process, and you're going to spend as much time trying to fundraise as you are working on your business. And if you do that and you set the expectation, you'll get it done. We'll figure out some way.
With all due respect to the companies, could you talk about some of those company deaths and why you think they happened?
Well, I'm so careful because, I mean, these are partners of Strava, and I have a lot of respect. And frankly, as an operator, I just know how hard it is. So let me talk to a company that I have a lot of respect for. And it's not that they're dead by any stretch, but I think we all know, I mean, Peloton has its ups and downs. They are a great partner of ours. And I actually think they come out the other side of this. Where I would compare the differences, one of the challenges that they face at Strava, never had to face, is they're a hardware company. And they're predicated, you know, a lot of their business was predicated on the success of selling stationary bikes and treadmills. And I believe now they have rowers and so forth, while they simultaneously were also building a digital business. So they just had a level of complexity that frankly we didn't have.
And I imagine with COVID, a lot more people were staying home. Could you actually use the machines?
Could use the machines, and you couldn't go to a gym.
Right.
You couldn't. Right. So the alternatives were. So there were a lot of things outside of their control. And that's the thing. I'm much more quick to defend Peloton and kind of where they are today and why I think they actually still have a great product and will come out the other side. You know, these expectations got, maybe we talked earlier, this phrase, success equals results minus expectations. They just reached this point where everybody thought that they would continue to just be on a growth rate that was off the charts. And I think what we all learned in hindsight, and this is a problem, it's really easy to be an armchair quarterback and sit back and say, well, didn't you see that was going to happen? Nobody was saying that. We didn't know. We didn't know if we would be going back to work. We didn't know if we could ever be working out together. So I think what Peloton has continued to have to work through is, what is the ongoing demand for the product? What is the right product mix? What does their business model look like relative to hardware versus software? And I think they'll get it right. I really do. I'm not just being blowing smoke. I think they're an important partner of ours, and we love what they do because they are another enabler of people being active. Trust me, I actually don't feel safe riding a bike out on the road very often. I'll do it to get to a good trail, but I've just had bad karma on the roads. If I can do a good workout indoors on a bike, I'm happy. And I don't think that's going to go away. That's an example of a company that, just like Strava and others, kind of went through a lot of ups and downs through the pandemic. Their recovery is just taking a little bit longer. But I'm optimistic. Yeah.
Absolutely. What are some spaces, especially in sports, that you're excited for young consumer entrepreneurs to build in? And what do you think are the biggest differences building a consumer company today from scratch versus, you know, 10, almost 20 years ago?
Well, I'll answer the second question first. And you and I alluded to this earlier. If I'm excited about particularly consumer technology today, I do love a lot of the automated tools that are out there that allow us to test and iterate solutions and put applications in front of consumers quickly. It doesn't have to be, perfection is not the goal. It's, can we develop things that we think are going to have a positive impact, somehow solve a problem, get it in front, and test and iterate. And Zane, it's why I love spending time with you, because I've watched your journey. And as you've talked about, you know, the apps that you've developed along the way and your ability to learn from each one, and you will find your sweet spot. You will find this product market fit and an opportunity, and you'll be off to the races. And I think that the tools that enable you to do that, they're very different from the tools that I had before. I graduated with a degree in art history. I've never written a piece of code in my life, yet I've successfully managed to found and build two software companies. I can do it. Anybody can do it. And I just think that today, the tools that are in front of us only make that easier. It means it's easier for everybody, so there's going to be competition, but competition is good. Like, competition means there's a real market. So that would be my first point, is like, don't fear it and test and iterate. Don't look for perfection. Get products early in the hands of users, because they will tell you whether you're onto something or not. Don't trust your instinct. In terms of sports spaces, I guess I'd state the, I'll point out two maybe really basic observations. One is, I continue to be impressed with the kinds of devices that we're wearing today and the kinds of data that those devices are capturing. I happen to be a big fan of, I don't have it on today, but typically I'm wearing a Garmin, and I also wear an Oura Ring. And those two alone, I'm just impressed on a weekly basis how they continue to iterate in terms of the kinds of things that they're capturing. And just because they're capturing the data doesn't mean that then other companies can't figure out a way to then take that information and create insightful products and services for them. So I really like that sort of this, the ability for very sort of simple, easy to use devices are capturing more and more information, which is exactly what happened in 2008 when we were launching, which was that Garmin was capturing a lot of information while somebody was riding a bike. And we were able to take that information and do unique things that the Garmin wasn't doing. And then we could do the complement Garmin. So we weren't trying to compete directly with them. We were trying to enhance someone's use. So I think that continued, whether it's glucose monitoring, whether it's sweat monitoring, whether it's different things with heart rate, whether it's sleep data. We're just seeing this whole new category of human performance and wellness data that I think we're only scratching the surface with what we can do with it. And then the second one, not to be a broken record, but it's funny, I just came from another meeting with an entrepreneur. AI as a tool, I think, will play a really interesting role in fitness and sports and wellness going forward. I don't put AI at the center of the conversation, but as we're thinking about, I'll use the example of coaching. As we're thinking about how people want to be coached to go do their first marathon or coached to do a century bike ride or something like that, I am excited about the way in which we can use some of these new technologies to provide greater access to coaching, create more personalization in coaching, lower cost solutions, so you don't have to hire somebody that you're paying, you know, hundreds of dollars every month, but actually using technology that they can look at what you're doing and iterate from there. And that's exciting, because that wasn't really available even 2 or 3 years ago. So those would be two examples.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time, Mark. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Yeah, it's fun. Anytime, Zane.